Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 16. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and joining me today to chat about Lady Jane Grey and Lettice Knowles is Nicola Tallis. Nicola has a first-class Bachelor of Arts with honours in history from Bath Spa University. She also has an MA in Public History from Royal Holloway College, University of London. Nicola has been passionate about English history all of her life and has worked as a curator, lecturer and historical researcher. She's currently the resident historian for Alison Weir Tours. Crown of Blood is the result of 5 years of research on the Grey family and is her first book. Elizabeth's Rival, The Tumultuous Tale of Lettice Knowles, Nicola's second book, is the first biography of this extraordinary Tudor lady. My conversation with Nicola straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales.
Thank you.
Welcome to Talking Tutors, Nicola. How are you?
I'm really good. Thank you very much for having me, Natalie.
Oh, I'm very excited to have you on the show. Now, I thought we could start by you just sort of introducing yourself and maybe giving us a little bit of background information.
Sure. Well, yes, I'm Nicola Tallis. Yes. I am the author of Crown of Blood, The Deadly Inheritance of Lady Jane Grey, which was released in the UK in 2016. And more recently, I am the author of Elizabeth's Rival, The Tumultuous Tale of Lettice Knowles, Countess of Leicester, which is the first full-scale biography of Lettice.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Thank fantastic. You.
And what sparked your interest in the Tudors?
It actually came from my mum when I was very young, and she used to tell me bedtime stories about King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table.
Right.
And from there it progressed to the Six Wives of Henry VIII, and by that time I was completely hooked.
Yeah It is very addictive, isn't it?
It sure is, yeah.
Fabulous, that's good. And so you mentioned your biography of Lady Jane Grey that you've written, and it's a fantastic biography. I absolutely loved it.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask you, what sort of drew you to Jane's story?
I think initially I was more interested in her mother, Lady Frances Brandon.
Okay.
And I spent quite a long time researching and writing about her. Mm-hmm. And it was actually my literary agent at the time who said to me that perhaps there was actually more to be said about Jane.
Mm-hmm.
And I at first I was a bit disappointed, because I sort of felt that perhaps we knew as much as we ever were going to know about Jane, and that there wasn't really anything new to say.
Mm-hmm.
But actually it was probably the best advice that I've been given, because when I went back and had a look at the source material, I realised, or I very much felt, that there was a new angle to the story that I could tell.
Mm.
And that I was perhaps able to draw out more of the human character in Jane than we'd seen to that point.
Absolutely, and I think you were very successful in doing that, definitely. Could you tell us a little bit about Jane's upbringing and her family?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she was primarily raised at Bradgate Park in the heart of the Leicestershire countryside.
Yeah.
And she was the eldest of three daughters born to her parents. And her parents invested very heavily in the education of Jane and her sisters. Jane's father in particular was a huge advocate of education.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his contemporaries remarked that he was well learned and a great wit.
Right.
And this seems to have rubbed off on Jane, because she very quickly demonstrated that she excelled in learning, and she really enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, fantastic. And so sort of moving along a little bit in Jane's life here. So she's often, you know, you see articles and blogs online and things, and she's referred to as the 9-day queen. But did she in fact reign for a little bit longer than this?
Yeah, absolutely. I personally class her reign from the moment of Edward VI's death on the 6th of July. And most people tend to date her reign from the 10th of July, which was when she was publicly proclaimed Queen of England.
Right.
But in my mind, she had been accepted by King Edward's council as Queen of England from the moment of his death.
Mm.
So that's my reasoning.
Right, okay. Yeah, and you still see it around a lot, don't you, the 9-day queen thing? And I always want to say, no, she went for a bit longer.
Yeah, exactly. I think 13 days perhaps doesn't have quite the same ring.
Yeah, that's right. All right, so it was obviously a brief reign. I was just wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about how she approached her queenship.
Yeah, I mean, there is this misconception, in my opinion at least, that she was this pawn who was very cruelly manipulated.
Mm.
And I think undoubtedly there are aspects of that story that are very true, but I think in this case, in the case of her reign, that that's actually doing her a bit of a disservice, because in my view at least, it's at this point that Jane actually really started to assert her authority and her character, because she may not have wanted to have been queen, but I think she had accepted that this was the role that God had given her, and she was determined to do it, perform it to the best of her ability. And as soon as word arrives that Mary intends to fight for the throne and isn't going to meekly submit to Jane's rule, she immediately begins to assert her authority, and she sends out she sends out a number of proclamations across the realm commanding her subjects to come to her aid and support her claim to be Queen of England. And she really does try to assert her authority. For example, also I think it had been assumed that she would just go along with whatever the Duke of Northumberland and King Edward's council had wanted her to. But I think they got a bit of a shock when she put her foot down and said that there was no way she was going to make her husband Guildford Dudley King of England unless she was petitioned to do so by Parliament. So she really does try to make her voice heard, and I think that's often overlooked.
So I think, I know when people think of Lady Jane Grey, a lot of the times we're picturing these sort of 19th century interpretations of her. Like, for example, very famous one is Paul Delaroche's painting of Jane's execution, and that's a 19th century painting where she's depicted as this kind of childlike, you know, virginal, innocent. You've sort of touched on this a little bit, that you encountered a very different woman. Could you go into this a little bit further, sort of the woman that you found during your research?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, again, something that is really overlooked is just how intelligent Jane was also. And she did really, really want to be noticed. And she, something that really struck me as quite extraordinary about her was the influence that Heinrich Bullinger, the Protestant reformer and theologian, had on her and on shaping her views. And I think that this becomes apparent particularly in her teenage years, when her tutor John Elmer was struggling with her a little bit, because she was, in the manner of so many other teenage girls, she was taking too much of an interest in clothes and her music, and she wasn't devoting herself to her studies as much as Elmer would have liked her to. And all of his admonitions had fallen on deaf ears. And so in desperation, he wrote to Bullinger asking him to speak to Jane about this. And bear in mind, Bullinger's living in Switzerland at this time, but he obviously did write to Jane and tell her to knuckle down with her studies, and that's exactly what she did. And I just find it really remarkable that the main tutor in her life, John Elmer, who she sees every day, his words have no impact on her, but this man living in distant Switzerland, who tells her to get on with her work, and she does it. So
that's amazing, isn't it? When you were saying that, I was just picturing my 14-year-old daughter. I was thinking, who can I write to encourage? I've got to try someone else, I think. That sounds good. It is amazing that we often forget, like, she was obviously very young. You know, and it's funny that you say, she was interested in her music and her clothing, and it's so similar to some of the teenagers today. So it's interesting.
Absolutely. So there's definitely some comparisons to be drawn there.
That's really funny. Now, apart from Crown of Blood, which is your biography of Lady Jane Grey, which is fantastic, you've recently published, as you mentioned earlier on, the first biography of Lettice Knowles, which is really exciting. So Countess of Leicester, and that's called Elizabeth's Rival. What makes Lettice such a fascinating subject?
To be honest, when I came to research this, I was absolutely amazed that nobody else had written about her before, because the story is just so explosive. And I think that we can very fairly kind of claim that Lettice was probably one of the one of the few, or the only woman perhaps, who was partially responsible for possibly breaking Elizabeth I's heart,
right,
through her relationship with Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, makes her stand out as being extraordinary.
Yeah, that's quite amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and now something else that you mentioned in your book. So Lettice and Queen Elizabeth were in fact related, and there's even the possibility, and you, I think, call it very likely in your book, that Lettice was Henry VIII's illegitimate granddaughter. So could you explain the family connection for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, I do think that there's a very strong possibility that Lettice was perhaps more closely related to Elizabeth than has previously been acknowledged. Basically, what had happened was that Henry VIII, as we know, married Anne Boleyn and mm-hmm. produced Elizabeth I. But prior to that, of course, he also had an affair with Anne's sister, Mary Boleyn.
Mm-hmm.
And it was possibly this liaison that led to the birth of Catherine Carey, who mm-hmm. was Lettice's mother.
Right,
And so that's sort of the connection there. And it was never openly acknowledged during their lifetimes.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there is strong evidence to suggest that in court circles, Catherine Carey's true parentage was known.
Right.
And certainly, you know, Lettice would also have been aware of this. So, you know, during the reign of Elizabeth, Sir Philip Sidney, one of Sir Philip Sidney's poems, Astrophil and Stella,
mm-hmm.
talks about hiding royal blood.
Mm.
The muse for this poem was Lettice's daughter, Penelope Rich.
Right.
And yes, yeah, so he makes all of these allusions to Penelope's background. And I think that, yeah, that in itself is strong evidence to suggest that people were aware that, you know, Catherine Carey had been the product of Henry VIII's affair with Mary Boleyn.
Mm, isn't that intriguing? I wonder how Elizabeth felt about this family connection. Very interesting.
Absolutely,
I love it. It's such a tangled tale, isn't it? The Tudors. It's
I mean, it's very incestuous.
It is,
isn't it? So
yeah, gosh, amazing. So Lettice married Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, and you mentioned that obviously that was the Queen's favourite and possibly a person, well, I think highly likely someone that she was really in love with and loved a lot. So they married in September 1578. Do we know any details about the actual wedding ceremony?
We do know a little bit, thanks to the testimony of Leicester's chaplain, a man called Humphrey Tindall. And we know that he was approached only the previous day and asked, it was all very last minute, asked to perform a wedding ceremony on behalf of Leicester and Lettice. It was all staged with the utmost secrecy at Wanstead, which was Essex's home on the outskirts of London. Leicester's home on the outskirts of London.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that there were just a handful of people present at the wedding, including Leicester's brother, Ambrose Dudley, and Lettice's father, Sir Francis Knowles, and one of her brothers. And we also know that she was noted to have been wearing a loose gown, some people have taken as an indication that she was pregnant. The truth is we don't really know, but certainly if she was pregnant, then nothing came of the pregnancy.
I was going to ask you sort of, do you think that Dudley, I suppose, just got tired of waiting for the Queen, or what, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he did. I think there had been times, of course, when he was very hopeful that Elizabeth would marry him.
Yeah.
But I think certainly by the mid 1570s, it had become clear that that was never, ever going to happen. And although, of course, Elizabeth, I think, liked having him dangling on the end of a string. And I think in many ways, I think for Leicester, perhaps Lettice was the next best thing.
Right.
But I also think that there's no doubt that she was incredibly attractive.
Right.
So the Spanish ambassador referred to her as being one of the best looking ladies of the court. And we can see from her portraits that she was extremely striking in looks. And yeah, of course, she did also bear that very strong resemblance to Elizabeth
She did, yes, that's true. Now, we know that not much could be kept secret from Elizabeth for too long. Yeah. So how long did it take her to discover the betrayal, and how did she react when she found out?
So we don't know for certain exactly when she found out, but the likelihood is that it was in July 1579, so about 10 months after the secret marriage had taken place. And she was probably told the news by a French envoy, and it shook her to the core. She was completely horrified, and her initial reaction was to have Leicester sent to the Tower. And it was only thanks to the intervention of the Earl of Sussex who reminded the Queen that it wasn't actually against the law to marry without consent that she was prevented from doing this. But nevertheless, Leicester was told to absent himself from the court, and he left London to lie low and wait for the storm to blow over. And it was Lettice who was left to bear the brunt of the Queen's anger. And there is an account that says that this dramatic confrontation between the two women took place within the Queen's apartments at the Palace of Whitehall. And the Queen apparently completely let loose at Lettice, telling her that as but one sun lightened the earth, she would have but one Queen of England. And she apparently boxed her ears and banished her from court.
Right. Oh, my goodness, how terrifying for Lettice, goodness.
Yeah, not someone you want to get on the wrong side of.
No, and did they ever see each other again, or was that it for them too?
They did see each other again. Miraculously, but not for nearly 20 years.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
So, and by that time, Leicester was dead, but the animosity that Elizabeth felt towards Lettice when she saw her seems to have been as fresh as ever. And she'd been permitted an audience with Elizabeth thanks to the intervention of her son, the Earl of Essex, who was the new queen, was now the Queen's favourite. And I think he'd tried all that he could to effect a reconciliation between the Queen and his mother. But unfortunately, it didn't work. And on this occasion, it would be the last time that Lettice ever saw Elizabeth.
Right. Wow. Amazing story to, you know, hold that kind of anger for 20 years is really not good for you.
I know. No, it's absolutely bizarre.
Goodness me. And did Lettice remarry after Dudley or not?
She did, yes. She remarried rather quickly, actually.
Oh, did she?
she did. She remarried a man called Sir Christopher Blount, who had worked as in Leicester's household. And he was quite the interesting choice, because not only was he about 12 or 13 years younger than Lettice, but he was also a Catholic. She and her family were stringent Protestants. But he also seems to have worked as a double agent for Sir Francis Walsingham in the plots to secure the downfall of Mary, Queen of Scots. So quite an interesting character. And we don't know an awful lot about him, unfortunately. But the marriage between himself and Lettice does seem to have been one of genuine physical attraction, I think, and warmth and affection. And she, in her letters, she would always refer to him as being her best friend.
Right. And this may be a silly question, but is he any relation to Bessie Blunt or not?
the mistress? Yes, yeah, no, absolutely. Oh, okay. Yeah, so they're all, it's so interesting.
Everyone's related.
Everyone's related, so I forget the exact connection. I think they were cousins somewhere, but they were all connected.
How fascinating. I love it. All right, yeah. Cool. Now, out of all the sort of misconceptions that exist about Lettice or Lady Jane Grey, what do you think is one of the worst or the most persistent?
In the case of Lettice, mm-hmm. I think it was probably, it's probably that she was this awful she-wolf who broke Elizabeth I's heart. Yeah. And I think obviously it's true that she perhaps did break Elizabeth's heart. Mm. But the fact that people say she's a she-wolf, I think is a huge exaggeration, because at the end of the day, rightly or wrongly, she was just a woman who fell in love, mm-hmm. and who sought happiness. And she and Leicester, there's no doubt that they were happy. Yeah. So I think that it's very easy to look at everything from Elizabeth's point of view.
Yes, exactly.
But, you know, I think there are always two sides to the story.
Absolutely.
And with Lady Jane Grey, yeah, I think it's probably just the fact that she was just this victim who had no voice, and who wasn't capable of asserting her authority and speaking up for herself. Mm. And she definitely had a lot more to her than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just I was remembering, and I may have read this in your book, you can clarify, that while she was in the Tower, she was kind of sending, you know, what's the word for it? She was reprimanding Mary in certain things, you know, to do with religion, etc.
It was a former chaplain of her father's that she wrote a really quite vicious, yes, aggressive, yeah, letter to, and it was actually so strongly worded that, mm, Victorians later claimed that there was no way that poor innocent Lady Jane Grey could have written anything, right, like this. But yeah, the evidence very much points towards the fact that she did.
Yeah, well, it didn't match the romanticized 19th century version of Lady Jane Grey.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, I find that amazing, that being, you know, you're locked up in the Tower and you're obviously relying on Mary's goodwill, and you kind, yeah, of write to reprimand her. Like, I think that shows that she was, you know, her convictions were extremely strong, and that she was, yeah, yeah, very courageous too. And yeah, that's quite amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think by that time, you know, following the failure of the Wyatt Rebellion in January 1554, mm, I think she very much come to terms with the fact that she was going to die.
Yeah.
And if that was going to happen, then she was going to die remembered as a Protestant martyr.
Mm-hmm. Wow, goodness, amazing. How old was she, roughly, do we say? Sorry, I can't remember from
she knows, okay.
I'm trying to remember everyone's ages.
I know. So she, in all likelihood, she was 17,
wow,
at this time, and probably just a few months short of her 18th birthday, I would have said.
Goodness me, amazing, really.
Yeah, sad.
Yeah, it is. It's a tragic story, isn't it? I think whenever, yeah, I post about that sort of on social media, lots of people are kind of like, oh, sad face.
You know, yeah,
similar to when I post about Catherine Howard, I get a similar kind of response.
But, interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. Yeah, I think just, you know, their youth, I think obviously, you know, that moves people, of course, such, yeah, a terrible end for both women. But yeah, so Nicola, yeah, are you currently, can you tell us anything about any new books that you're working on?
I can.
Yay.
So for probably the last nearly 18 months now, I have been working on a new biography of Margaret Beaufort.
Oh, that's so exciting.
So I'm really super excited about that. And that will be released hopefully this sort of time next year.
Oh, that is so fantastic. And are you enjoying the research and enjoying getting to know her?
Absolutely. I really love it. And it's a little bit earlier for me.
Yes, yeah.
And so I'm really, really enjoying having the chance to delve into sources that I've perhaps not been, mm, so familiar with until this point. And I think the Margaret that I'm getting to know anyway is, mm, very different from the one that we see on screen in The yes. White Queen, for example.
Yeah, I know.
Because that is a very really great.
Yeah, fantastic. Because that's such a difficult character to connect with. Like, I know people often say, oh, no, I can't, you know, I can't yeah. connect with her in any way because of the way she's obviously depicted. So I'm really looking forward to seeing a more layered, I suppose, person, a more nuanced person. That's going to be really fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can't wait. It's on my TBR list already. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Fantastic. Well, we are up to playing our little game of 10 to go. Are you ready, Nicola?
I'm ready. Excited.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, if it was possible to travel, let's just imagine we could travel back in time temporarily, what piece yeah. of advice would you give your teenage self?
Oh, gosh, that's really interesting. I would give myself the exact same advice as Lady Jane Grey was given, which yep. was to work hard mm-hmm. and to not be so bothered about spending all my money on clothes and makeup.
That's so true. I love it. I think, yeah, I would have said something similar. So yeah. what do you do to relax?
What's that? On a serious note, to relax, I really love baking. And I always find that really therapeutic. So particularly at this time of year when there's all the Christmas cakes and things to be made. So yes, that's definitely my outlet.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, I love baking too. It's very, very, I think it's good for the soul, to be honest. So yeah.
Yes, that's a good way of describing it. Yeah.
And so you mentioned Christmas. So what's one or two sort of favourite Christmas traditions that you have?
Well, I always love watching The Nightmare Before Christmas on Christmas Eve.
Oh, lovely.
I don't know why. but that's always been a long-standing Christmas tradition.
Yeah.
And on Christmas Day, we always have a sprout eating competition.
A sprout eating? So,
yeah.
I never heard of that before. So tell me more. How does that work?
So it's just where we all have a big dish of sprouts and we see who can eat the most sprouts, which was influenced by the Vicar of Dibley Christmas right. special, where they do a similar kind of thing. Oh. And I don't know where that one came from, but I think one year we just thought that would be fun and it's yeah. stuck ever since.
That is so funny. Are you any good at it?
I'm really good. Yeah, honestly. When I was young, I used to hate them.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But they've grown on me now. So, yeah, I think, I guess I could probably manage 9 or 10.
Wow, that's impressive. You're doing really well. I love it. I've never heard of that tradition, so I absolutely love that. Nicola, what are two items that are on your bucket list?
Two items that are on my bucket list. I would really, really love to visit Australia, actually.
Yay! Please do.
That is really quite high on my bucket list. I've always really wanted to do that. And some of my partner's family live there, so I've really got an excuse not to go.
Yeah.
I'd love to do that. And something else on my bucket list is I would really love to be able to write a book about something that I don't know anything about from a different period. So perhaps the Victorians have always really grabbed me. That would take years of research because it's not my my natural sort of field, but that's would funny. Really love to write something a little bit different.
That'd be a great challenge, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. I always think it's good to challenge yourself.
Yeah, exactly. So where are your partner's family, where do they live here in Australia?
They live in Melbourne.
Oh, okay. Yes. So, excellent. Well, you'll have to come to Sydney as well so that we can catch up if you come to Australia.
Desperate to come to Sydney.
Yes, you'll love it. It'll be good. All right. What's a favourite holiday destination?
Portugal, the Algarve. I absolutely love it there. I've been going since I was 18 and I've just got very, very happy memories. And it's just such a nice, laid back and chilled place. So I always love Portugal, and of course lots of history there too.
Absolutely, yeah. And I really want to visit because I've got lots of ancestors that were from Portugal, so that would be really fantastic. Yeah.
You must.
Yeah, I will. It's on my list. Describe your ideal Saturday night.
Not long ago it would have been going out partying, but now I'm I feel like since I've hit my 30s, I need to calm myself down a bit. So actually, probably my ideal Saturday night these days would be a nice takeaway, a bottle of wine, just being able to just chill and either curl up with a good book or just watch a good film.
That sounds perfect, perfect, perfect. What books are currently on your bedside table?
I am just coming to the end of The House of Beaufort by Nathan. So I've really been enjoying that. That's been really fascinating, and really impressed by the amount of research that Nathan did for that.
That's interesting that you mentioned that. That's a great segue because I'm talking to him tomorrow. So that'd be really...
Oh, fantastic.
So I'll let him know. I'll let him know that you loved it. He'll be so pleased.
Yeah, honestly, I really think that it's a massive triumph for Nathan. That's great.
Oh,
that's but after that, I'll be moving on to Isabella of Castile by Giles Tremlett.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I read his Catherine of Aragon biography, but I haven't read that one yet.
So I'm
sure that'll be great. All right, fantastic. Now I think you may have answered this question already with your Christmas tradition, but is there something that most people don't know about you? Now we know you're Brussels sprouts
that
champion.
That is one thing. but I think also most people may not know that I actually started out as a beauty therapist
before I came
to work in history. So that's a little bit different.
That is a little bit different. And what made you sort of change fields or go to history?
I'd always wanted to work in history, but unfortunately, when I was at school, it was when we came to do our exams, it was all history that I didn't really have much interest in. And, typical. And and so my history teacher had said to me, oh, I think you actually need to consider a different career path. I went away and did beauty therapy, and then I snapped a ligament in my wrist and couldn't do that anymore. It was at that point that I thought, well, it's now or never, really. I went back to university and studied history.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's really, what an inspiring story to just follow, follow your heart and do what it is that you love. That's really awesome.
Thank you.
I love that.
I'm glad that I did it.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Do you have any guilty pleasures that you care to confess? You can say no, that's okay.
I don't know if I have. I'm very partial to a pink gin. I'm making myself sound like a complete drinker now.
That's all right. That's what happens to most people when they start talking. Oh, that's all right. That's all
And I have been known to sit up till 2-3 in the morning writing whilst with a pink gin in the other hand.
I like the sound of that. That's good. All right. That's a fine guilty pleasure.
That's not too guilty.
No, that's not too bad at all. Lucky last, I think I've lost count. I've probably asked you about 12. But anyway, what's one book that you wish everyone would read?
One book that I wish everyone would read. This is tricky. Oh, okay. I think I would say The Private Lives of the Tudors by Tracy Borman.
Yes, I just finished.
I think that's a really good way for perhaps somebody who's new to Tudor history to engage with it, because I think it gives you such a different perspective on the Tudors, and it's full of such interesting little tidbits. And and just obviously in the same way as all of Tracy's books, it's brilliantly researched and really engagingly written.
It is. I made the mistake, which I won't make again, of listening to that on Audible. So I'd go for my walks and I'd listen, but then there were so many things that I wanted to note down and, delve further into. So of course I'm going to have to buy the hard, copy book anyway. So I learned my lesson there. Only listen to fiction while I'm walking. I think that's the kind of, the lesson, and listen to my and read my nonfiction. So then I can mark things.
Good idea.
I learned something new there. All right, fantastic. So Nicola, what's your Tudor takeaway for us today?
I think my Tudor takeaway would be to go away and watch the film Lady Jane, yes, by Trevor Nunn, which was released in the 1980s. And I really feel that whilst it's not historically accurate, mm-hmm, it is a really great introduction to Lady Jane Grey's story and really helps you to immerse yourself in the Tudor period.
Wonderful. That's, I don't know if I've watched that. Who plays Lady Jane Grey in that one?
Helena Bonham Carter.
Oh, yes, I think I have seen. Yeah, I think I saw it quite some time ago.
Yeah, and it's so, honestly, I can't watch it without crying still.
Oh, I know. She's such an amazing actress, so versatile.
Brilliant.
She could do lots of different things.
Yes, she is.
That's incredible. Oh, I love that. I'm going to definitely note that down and rewatch it again. That's fantastic.
Yeah,
now, I hope, this has been so wonderful, and I really hope that I can book you in next time when your new book is out and we can talk.
Oh,
and we can talk Margaret.
Yeah, I'd love that.
Oh, that's going to be so fantastic. So thank you so much for your time today. And I hope that you and your family have a beautiful Christmas, Nicola.
Thank you very much for having me, Natalie. And very same back to you.
Oh, thank you. And yeah, we'll talk again soon. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.